episode 231 of The Infectious Myth. We have a long interview this week, so let's get right to it. My guest today goes by the name Ben. Online, they are GNC-centric on Twitter, YouTube, and Medium. She's a Canadian woman who for some time identified as a transgender man, but she decided to detransition and live again as a female, a woman. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Maybe the first question I can ask you is why you've decided to use a male name when you've come back to living as a woman.
Well, a few reasons. The first reason is when I switched names, in my mind at least, I was 13. But when I actually like switched names with everybody in real life, I was 16 and I didn't detransition until I was 20. So in my mind, going back to my birth name, that was the name of a little girl. And when I detransitioned, I was an adult. And it seemed just like a completely different person. It seemed disingenuous to go back. I also discovered that there's kind of a history of lesbians having male names. And part of my detransition was realizing that I was a lesbian. So I kind of felt it had some kind of new connection with the name.
Okay, and that I think is important. I mean, I don't think we can say that all women who decide to become transgender men are lesbians, but would you say the majority are?
It's really hard to tell because sexuality does change on testosterone and sexual behavior, I think, is different within the environment of the queer community. But I think there is a significant number of lesbians who transition, yes.
Yes. You know, I've read from a number of women in this circumstance, and it seems like difficulty accepting their own sexuality is maybe at the root of this, like maybe not wanting to accept that they are a lesbian, that they're attracted to other women. And somehow, I mean, I don't understand this, but somehow it's easier to consider yourself a heterosexual man than it is a homosexual woman?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we can start from like any age. If you're right now the age of 13 and you go into the Gay Straight Alliance at your high school and you tell them that you're a lesbian, it is inevitable the topic will come up of you're a lesbian, would you date a trans person? Like a trans-identified male who identifies as a woman. And from a young age, these lesbians are learning that having boundaries and actually being a homosexual female is not okay. And around them, all of their friends are transitioning. And I don't mean that like in an exaggerated way. I mean, literally, all of their friends are transitioning. So when you're the last lesbian standing and all of the gender nonconforming females you've ever met in your life are trans men, and all of the happy gender nonconforming females that you've ever met, they're like trans men married to women or something.
Right.
Why wouldn't you see that as the solution? Like for me, the first time I ever met a butch lesbian, I was 21 after I had detransitioned. It didn't seem like a possibility to me.
Well, that's interesting because Gay Straight Alliances, I live in Alberta and there's been a big political fight over Gay mm-hmm. Straight Alliances, and the sort of more left-wing party, the NDP, was strongly in favor, and the conservatives were kind of put into a corner and they didn't want to come out against it, but they kind of were passively aggressively against it. And they said, okay, if you're going to join a GSA, the school's going to tell your parents, which I could see could be very dangerous depending on who mm-hmm. your parents are. If they assume that being in a GSA means you're gay or trans or something like that, when in actual fact, a lot of people in a Gay Straight Alliance are just supporters, right?
Yeah, just friends
hanging anything.
Out.
I mean, not that being gay should be something that causes your father to beat you up, right? Like that's not right. But it would certainly endanger children in this case. It's different than joining the library club or, you know, the track club or something like that.
But in my experience, though, in Canada, when you come out as trans in high school, based on like me and my friends and even teenagers in Canada that I know right now, like the school and the guidance counselors, they're more than happy to hide it from your parents. Like there's no question that they're happy to hide your transition from your parents if you're socially transitioning at school and not at home.
Yes. And I mean, I think this illustrates the split between the so-called progressives and the conservatives. Like teachers probably tend to vote more liberally, more mm-hmm. on the left wing of things. And so the progressives have completely bought the idea that people literally can change their sex And conservatives are saying, no, this is, I mean, deep down, I think a lot of conservatives feel, you know, we're dealing with a bunch of messed up gay people and they don't want to support that. Right? There's kind of two extremes and everybody's trying to be polite, but that seems to be the division.
Well, I think part of the problem too is like the social workers and guidance counselors and school teachers and everyone, what their perspective is like, if a kid comes out to you as gay, this is not like an optional thing or a choice. They're like born this way, right?
Right.
So when a kid comes out to you as trans and they're quote unquote born of the wrong body, that's just the way it is. So you accept them. It's the same thing. I think that's the thinking of most normal people when it comes to like gay or trans kids. So
yeah, and I think it's probably a genuine concern, right?
I mean,
it's easy to assume. I mean, I guess this gets to a fundamental point. Their assumption is that supporting somebody through their transition is the best way to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we can talk about your experiences. There are a lot of people who are finding that that's not true.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about your family circumstances, and obviously you want to be a little circumspect because you're maintaining your anonymity. But one of the things that's been observed by some of the psychologists I've interviewed is that a lot of people who are transitioning have, you know, a basket full of psychological issues. Perhaps they have an eating disorder, or they've got depression or autism or things like that, that there's rarely somebody who comes out as trans who doesn't have anything. And I think a lot of those things are related to, you know, a difficult family upbringing. So can you describe some of the aspects of your family that caused you some grief and turmoil inside?
Mm-hmm. I think before I really get into it, you have to keep in mind that I grew up like this. So I thought it was normal until I was an adult. I didn't realize this stuff was unusual until I was like kind of out of the house.
I guess, to some extent, that's true of everybody, right? Like you grow up sheltered, and if your dad smacks you every day, you just assume every dad does it, right? You don't really know.
Yeah, actually. But from a very young age, my dad's family is Mennonite.
Okay.
So we would hang out with them a lot with all my cousins when I was little. And it was all about like who has the most sons and like, are the girls helping can the peaches and things like that. Everything was very, very gendered. And it was expected that if you're a girl, you wear skirts and you're going to grow up to be a mother or a school teacher. And like, that's your only option.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of, that was like my early childhood. I remember that kind of stuff very clearly. And I think it really colored my opinion of like the whole girl boy divide at that age. I was like, oh, this is all garbage. And then my family kind of became estranged from them. And then I mostly had like
estranged from the Mennonites.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Which was, I think, a good thing, just like for everyone. But my family, they were very good about like allowing me to be gender nonconforming as a kid. Like I had more Hot Wheels than I had Barbies and that kind of thing, or like Tonka or whatever. My parents were very like supportive. But at the same time, I remember all the time being told, like, you have to shave your legs and, like, you need to sit like a lady and, like, don't speak like that. It's not ladylike. So, like, I have, like, all these mixed signals from my childhood. Two things that had a big impact on just my mental health in general as a child was I was kind of being abused at home. My parents hurting me. Most
like
of the
physically
yeah.
abusing you.
So most of the time it was, like, emotional blackmail and, like, just yelling and screaming and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But then, like, pretty often it was also like physical violence, like spankings and beatings with belts and that kind of thing. And it went on into like my mid teenage years.
Mm-hmm.
So that had an effect on me. I think it had an effect on the way I perceived control over my body or control over my environment or something like that. That's what I theorize anyway.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess when you're being punished, you kind of internalize there's got to be a reason for this and what can I do to stop it. And I think if you grow up with parents who resort to violence frequently, they're probably not going to change unless something dramatic happens.
Yeah.
So you could change and it wouldn't make any difference.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I really internalized that idea of like, there's nothing that I can change about my environment, so I have to be the one to change on some level. But again, this is all in retrospect, like years later, looking back. You can't expect kids to understand this when they're 15 and they're at the therapist's office. Anyway, And then also I had, I started having anorexia around the time, like around 11, and my family, they were very much like, kind of like tough it out. Like if you choose to be better, you'll be better. That kind of thing.
So anorexia in the not wanting to eat, like deliberately not eating to try to wait.
Sometimes I wouldn't eat for like 3 days at a time and I would faint in class. And my parents' response was just to like shame me for like making them have to leave work to come get me from school and stuff.
Right, right.
So it felt very much like all of this was my fault and my problem. And then I also was diagnosed with depression at 13. And that's when I became suicidal. And I went on antidepressants. But again, my family was very much like, don't cause troubles for the family. And like, you don't need like medicine, take care of it yourself kind of thing. And I was kind of like left out in the blue with that. So I learned very early on, like not to make my problems their problems and to keep everything to myself.
And, you know, we're learning now more about the dangers of antidepressants. Like they're not good drugs. I've interviewed a couple of people on that. And I just saw some writings by guys named David Healy and Peter Gotchi on how the antidepressants were approved on the basis of trials that didn't show that they worked. because you can get anything approved by the government.
It's similar to another thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's
so it doesn't actually have to do anything good as long as it's similar to something that did something good.
Yeah, you get the spinmeisters in charge and they show up at the FDA or Health Canada or whoever, and pretty soon you've got the drug approved, and you know, everybody assumes it's being government approved, it's got to be good for you. And I think you're referring to hormones as you know, essentially approved therapy.
Yeah. Well, can I quickly address the antidepressants? So I kind of have a personal thing, and then I want to say about like a general thing to do with dysphoria and transition. So for me personally, I went on antidepressants, like a pretty high dose when I was 13, because I had a chronic pain condition, and my genius doctors were like, oh, it's just stress or something. So that happened. And then I stayed on the really high dose because I was suicidal and I was depressed. So my doctors were like, yeah, you should be on that. And then when I was 18, I went off of them for 2 weeks and I suddenly experienced like sexual arousal and libido for the first time in my life.
Oh, and yeah, that doesn't surprise me because they do suppress
they kill your libido. Yeah. So like, can you imagine the confusion for like a kid who at that time I was identifying as like a gay trans man twink or something like that. And for the first time in my life, I felt sexual attraction. And I was like, so everything I felt up to now is like a lie or synthetic or my imagination. It was really confusing. And my dysphoria went through the roof. It was the worst my dysphoria ever was. So I went back to my doctor and doubled my dose of antidepressants in an attempt to kill my libido. I asked him to chemically castrate me, and he was like, there's nothing we can do for females that isn't like chemotherapy or something. So he's like, no doctor would approve that, to chemically castrate you.
But I mean, yeah. that level of sort of self-hatred, I mean, I always thought, and anorexia is not something I've really looked into that deeply, but I always thought it would be, you know, a heterosexual woman who doesn't feel she's attractive enough, so loses weight to be more attractive. But it seems like the motivations for you being anorexic obviously had nothing to do with that, right? Because you're not sexually attracted to men.
It's really confusing. So I actually thought, because I didn't feel sexual arousal until I was 18, I never had a chance to like experience who I'm attracted to, right? Mm-hmm. So everything was just kind of like psychological. And I think on some level, I really, really did want to fit in. But it's very confusing. Wait, okay, I just want to tell my little thing about antidepressants before we move
sure.
on to this.
Okay, yeah.
So I know a handful of trans people who they were on antidepressants and antipsychotics and testosterone, and they stopped everything. I'm not suggesting this to anyone. I'm just saying they stopped everything, and their mental health and their dysphoria got much better. And they said like it was just years and years of like focusing on this issue and being on all these meds like really messed with their mind, and that it helped to go off of them. But I also know people who said, I went on antidepressants and my dysphoria and my depression are much better. Why did I think I needed to transition? I could have just had antidepressants. So I think that there's a general lack of investigating and a general lack of like addressing specific issues when it comes to anybody who presents with dysphoria.
Yes.
But my sexuality thing, sorry.
No, continue.
Okay, so now that I look back, I can 100% recognize that all the times I thought I had crushes on boys, it was me fantasizing about wanting to be that boy. And I didn't have a way in my mind to separate the two because it didn't occur to me that that might be a possibility.
Well, in transgender women, you know, biological males, they refer mm-hmm. to autogynephilia, which is mm-hmm. like the, it's almost like you're sexually attracted to yourself, the idea of yourself as the opposite sex.
And I think there is autoandrophilia as well, but it's a much smaller phenomenon.
Right. I mean, I think there's a difference between, you know, wishing that you were the opposite sex because you're attracted to the same sex, and then, you know, attracted to the idea, in the case of a male, of yourself in a dress with breasts and as like a sexually attractive woman. Mm-hmm. So do you think this was just, in your case, basically repressed lesbianism?
Yeah, 100%. I was so repressed. I mean, I felt attraction at 18, and I started to question gender ideology at 18. It wasn't until 20 that I came out as a lesbian.
And what are the attitudes of Mennonites to lesbians?
Oh, I haven't seen those people since I was 16. But...
Okay, so you really didn't, because at that point you didn't really think of yourself as a lesbian.
Well, like, I mean, I don't think I would be allowed into any of their houses with like a shaved head and pants.
My understanding is that Mennonites vary a lot in kind of how...
Yeah, well, I lived in Manitoba for a while, and in Manitoba there's like a really big Mennonite population, and there's like a big spectrum of like how conservative they are, or how like, I don't know, like fundamentalist they are versus like how liberal they are. Right. And there are actually like so many just like, I don't really know how to say this, just like normal people who are Mennonites. They're not like hardcore conservative, hardcore religious, like trying to convert you types.
Right. I mean, people show their conservatism in different ways, like dressing differently.
But so there is definitely like, you know, Christians of all types who are comfortable with that kind of thing. I don't think it was, I think that the religious stuff had more of an impact on me to do with like gender roles and less to do with sexuality. But I mean, I don't know. It's definitely possible that that had a big effect on me.
Yeah, I think I understand, because when you're, you know, when you're pre-sexual, right, when you haven't gone through puberty and you're not really feeling sexual attraction, I mean, you might be sort of attracted to if you were, say, a heterosexual girl, you might be sort of attracted to the idea of a man, but not in a sexual way. You just think the guy's handsome or he's hot or something. You don't really know what that means sexually. And so, you know, you want to grow up and have a husband and babies, and you know, that's sort of the idealized gender role.
Yeah,
that's what you were revolting against.
I remember like whenever they would come over and I would see my aunts who have like seven babies, and I would be like, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be like my entire life is changing diapers. And I was like, I don't want to. And also like the way that they run their families is very patriarchal, and I was like, I don't want to be like running around following the whims of some man. So from a young age, I told my mom, like, I don't want to have kids and I don't want to get married. Like, I literally told my parents that when I was like seven. And by the time I was in high school, I had this idea that I could like adopt kids and live by myself and have like some female friends that would like help me co-parent or something. But like, I had like all of these little things in my mind that were like, oh, I just need to be like independent. But looking back, they're all ways of just rationalizing why I couldn't be with a man, I think.
Right. But I mean, it's also true that there's women who are distinctly heterosexual who have similar feelings, because they don't want to have seven babies. You know, they want to have a career. And they want a different relationship with their future husband than, you know, he tells me what to do. And, you know, I'm the weak female. Like, I think...
Yeah,
you're not alone. You don't. It's not just people who are going to end up finding out that there are lesbians who have this feeling in a conservative family. Many people have that, but of course, you probably feel isolated, because even those girls who, you know, I want to be a doctor, and you know, I'm going to have one child and whatever. They also feel alone, right? Because they can't.
Yeah, I've definitely like I know women who are involved in the child-free movement, and it's definitely like a socially isolating experience, especially depending on your family. But I also, every single woman in my mom's family has had their first child before the age of 21, between the ages of 19 and 21. And as a teenager, I felt like it was inevitable that something horrible would happen to me and I would end up being pregnant. And it was like a fear I had.
So your dysphoria, your dislike of your own female body, do you think that was part of the pushback against, you know, my breasts, my period, they're all reminding me that I'm going to end up being married to a guy and have 7 babies, right? Is that kind of what you were, where it came from? Or
I'm not sure, honestly. Like, it seemed to have nothing to do with sex at all at the beginning. At the beginning, it was literally just the actual anatomy. The existence of it was a problem. Like, the material existence of, like, breasts on my body was like, what the hell is that? It didn't, at that age, it didn't go any further than that. I can't, it's possible that it is what you say.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, I don't wanna put ideas.
I think it had more to do with just like disliking my body. Like I said, like when I was anorexic and everything, I think I really hated myself on some level, and maybe just focusing on anatomy was, I don't know, something to focus on. I'm not 100% sure, but it definitely has something to do with like having control. And I always felt that, especially as a teenager, that like I would end up with a guy and he would be in control, and then we would just do what he wanted based on like all of the friends from like all the stories from my friends at the time. Like that's what they did with their boyfriends. And I thought I would just like be somebody's like property to be used or something. I don't know. I had like a lot of negative associations with like what would eventually happen with my body.
Yeah, it's pretty hard as an adult to psychoanalyze your thoughts as a child before you became aware of sexuality and sexual desire and all of those different things.
But I just remember like when I did get my breasts, it became like something in my life that now like boys or men were looking at me. Like the first time I was catcalled, I was 12 years old.
Right.
And like I was on a university campus at night walking like to a residence, and there was like 4 dudes in the car that like rolled down the windows and like whistled out and like waved at me and everything. And like when I got my period, I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to go to sex ed, so I thought I was dying because I just like woke up in a pool of blood and I was in pain. Right. And then my mom like gave me a box and a box of tampons and like went to school and left me alone for the day. And like I was so isolated, I had no one to talk to, and I was just like disgusted and horrified. And I think I just continuously felt like my body was betraying me.
I can understand why women go through more changes, especially with the period. That's something you know, especially in an environment where you're not told what it is and what to expect. Mm-hmm. It can create a lot of shame in a woman. And of course, in some cultures, it's, you know, menstruating women are forbidden to go to, say, a temple or something like that.
There was a lot of shame in my family. Like, I wasn't allowed to say the words period or pad or tampon to my mom. I would just ask her if she could buy me quote-unquote special things. And, like, I wasn't allowed to talk to my sister about her having her period, so I don't even know, like, when she got it. We weren't allowed to talk about it. And, like, when we had menstrual products in the house, we had to like hide them inside the garbage can so nobody else could see that we were on our period. Like, we weren't allowed to complain about cramps. Like, it was like very, there was so much shame attached to it. But at the time, I thought it was just like, this is a private issue you're not supposed to share with people or something.
As if not half the population goes
exactly
through this.
And also, like, similarly, we weren't allowed to talk about having crushes or dating or getting married or anything. My mom told us we had to like go to university and get jobs, and we weren't allowed to date anybody until we were 25.
Which is kind of anti-Mennonite, right?
Like, yeah. Well, it's just because like all the women in her family were having babies before they got married, and she wanted us to like have a solid financial situation before we did, I think. Like, again, I don't know if these things were like negatively intentioned, but the outcomes were negative, I think.
Well, yes, you know, it's one of those things, like the fact that women should have more opportunities, that they shouldn't have to feel that they have to have a baby in order to, you know, be a quote real woman. That doesn't mean that some women don't want to have lots of babies, right? They don't want it.
Yeah.
Some women want to get married at 19 to a guy who's strong and tells them what to do. And that is also okay, right? Like, you don't have to become like a strong feminist woman, that you should have the freedom to choose your path. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's important that parents talk to their children so that they learn all the different options, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people end up having a lot of babies and, you know, didn't give a lot of thought to it, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Married young and they have a lot of babies and all of a sudden they realize I'm trapped at home and I wanted to have a career. Like, what happened, right? People make bad decisions when they're young because they're not mature. Some of them are hard to get out
definitely.
Of. Another thing I found very interesting about your description, you started to go online a lot and you entered some very sexualized places online, but I think you referred to an online sexual relationship with a man where you were not actually experiencing the sexual relationship. You were just like participating as an actor.
Yeah. So I got like involved with like the trans activist, liberal feminist, third wave feminist corner of Twitter and Tumblr when I was like 13 and 14. And by the time I was 14, I was like sexting with older male allies. But when I say sexting, it was like they were doing something on their end and they were saying like their fantasy, what they wanted, whatever. And I was just kind of like playing along, like you said, acting. Mm-hmm. And I think that I felt like this is what you were supposed to do, or this is what they needed to be happy, so I might as well give it to them. Something like that. I had some kind of rationale as to why this was a good thing to do. But I also, on some level, felt like I was growing up or being more mature. And now I look back and it's literally just grooming, right? But that started when I was 14 and it kept going. I eventually had an online dom at the age of 17.
So in terms of a dominant personality online, who would...
Yeah, because I went on FedLife to find a dom when I was 17, which is a horrific idea. Nobody should do that. And
okay, so FetLife is something I was not aware of.
Okay.
I assume the Fet is for fetish?
Yeah. It's basically just like a huge website with like for people with fetishes, and there's like also different sub forums of different types, like different specific types, people's different interests, different experiences, stuff like that. And on that website, I found like a lot of really scary, horrifying shit. And I think that like I wanted to be treated badly, or I didn't think I deserved to be treated any better, something like that. But I made friends with this guy who was like, he was very critical of what I was reading. I would come to him and be like, people are saying this. Does this make sense to you? And he was somebody who had real life experience in BDSM, like in like circuits, in like the circuit. And he was like telling me all the bad things about BDSM. So to me, he seemed like really trustworthy. Like he was really looking out for me. But eventually we were sexting like every other day, every 2 days. It really warped my perception of like what a sexual relationship is supposed to be.
Well, yes. I mean, you're kind of... emulating kind of a Victorian ideal of a woman who puts up with sex because her man needs the relief, but the woman doesn't feel anything, because if you're a good woman, you obviously wouldn't feel sexual attraction. But it seemed to me that what you're also illustrating is that when children get involved in highly sexualized environments, they're not really exploring their sexuality. They're exploring, like, what am I supposed to do, right? I'm being told by the people.
It's confusing now and complicated, because we have like all the sex positivity mixed in with like the LGBT. So like when I joined LGBT, like the LGBT part of the internet, I thought I was going to talk to like gay men about what it's like to be a gay man, because at the time I thought I was a gay trans man, right? Mm-hmm. So I misguidedly believed that I would have a similar experience to them in some way. And then what ended up happening was like I found a lot of like trans-identified people who were in the sex industry, either as like cam girls or like escorts online or like porn online or something like that. And they would all have like their main Twitter where they tweeted about like trans activist stuff, and they would have a link on there to their sex work Twitter. And they would reblog this stuff and retweet this stuff all the time. So you would just be like scrolling through your feed on Twitter or Tumblr, and you would suddenly see like really graphic like BDSM porn or something. And you were supposed, like, if you didn't want to see that, it seemed like there's something wrong with you, because like sexual liberation and all that kind of thing. But I was like so young and it was making my dysphoria worse. But I really thought like this is what you have to do to be like a good, progressive, accepting person, right?
Yes. I'm all for sex positivity and for people actually
What it means in reality is that you're not allowed to ask questions or be critical of anything, because that's like kink shaming or something. So that means that you'll have like 28-year-olds explaining the like positive aspects of a like slave master relationship, and the teenagers who are listening, if they say anything against it or question anything, they're like king shamers and something is wrong with them. So you just basically are being like told what you should believe and what you should think and what you should be okay with, and you're not supposed to ask questions or anything.
Right. I mean, I guess it's like with anything else. I mean, if couple, whether gay or straight, wants to have a very conservative sexual relationship because they're both are turned off by things like oral sex or whatever, then that's fine, right? Like, you shouldn't have to have like a super exciting sex life if you don't really feel that's for you. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you want to be into BDSM, that's great, but that should be a choice that you make
as an adult
without being pressured into it because everybody's doing it, and if you don't do it, then you're obviously a square kind of.
Mm-hmm. And on Tumblr, there was like, at least at the time when I was on like the fetish side of Tumblr, there was like all of these posts that were like, I always felt aimless and I always felt like I didn't know what to do and I want to make people happy, and then I found my master and they told me how to make them happy and now my life is complete or something. And that's like every friggin' teenager feels that way. So what you basically have is like a grooming system to like get teenagers thinking that they're subs looking for masters, and then you have all these adult dominance like looking for them. It's messed up.
Yes. And I mean, what, you know, what's your feeling about an online sexualized relationship, sexual or sexualized, versus like a real relationship when you're actually physically with a person?
Well, it's very different, which is why for so long I was able to like keep up the pretense that I was attracted to males, because I could just imagine things however I wanted in my mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're extremely different. Online is not real life. And online, you don't know how the person on the other end is feeling or what their intentions really are. I think the people that I was sexting, to me, I thought they were treating me like a mature teenager or whatever, but I think they honestly were thinking of me as like a like young teenage girl who was like being manipulated by them. And like real life sex, you can kind of tell more.
Well, besides, like if you have a real relationship, I mean, not only you spend more time together, but it's, I mean, I know there's guys in particular who have like a whole bunch of women on the go, but if you spend a lot of time with one person, if you're living with that person, it's pretty easy to see if they're just into you. But with an online relationship, you know, once you sign off, they could just go on to another one of their, you know, group, their little harem of teenage girls.
Yeah.
Right. So there's not really a relationship with you. It's like they're saying the same thing to somebody else.
Yeah. And also it's like with the whole sex positivity thing now, it seems like sex is very like programmatic instead of like instinctual or passionate. It's like a list of like yes, no categories and a list of like yes, no actions. And it's very like impersonal. Like I'm not against consent or anything. I'm just saying like, so from a teenager who doesn't experience sexual attraction, doesn't have any physical experience, they're like seeing this like checklist of yes, no, and thinking that's what sex is.
Right.
And it's like, it's very like inaccurate, right?
I'd like to talk about your transition a little bit and then your detransition. So you got as far as getting hormones, but I think you said you never took them. I mean, were you also thinking about future surgery?
Yeah. So because of my relationship with my parents, I never came out to them. And it was, my plan was to go to university in Manitoba, and like get surgery and hormones there, and then to just come home at Christmas or something and be like, I'm a man, too bad, deal with it. By the time I got to university, I was like really gender critical and I ended up detransitioning before I took any medical steps. But okay. So from the beginning, I started to like question things when I was 13, and that's when I found transition timelines on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And I became very, very obsessed, and I was obsessed with the trans YouTubers. And back then the trans YouTubers, they weren't like now, they didn't have like high production value and like videos every day. They were like random people vlogging about like their experience with the doctors and their experience with their girlfriend or whatever. And it seemed more like personal, but I became very obsessed with this idea that like somebody who thought they were an ugly female could take hormones and like work out and eat right and like take care of themselves, and they could eventually look like a handsome man. And that was like really fixating. Yeah. So, yeah. I eventually came out to most of my friends when I was like 15 or 16. And then I came out at school when I was 16, and then all my teachers and everybody called me Ben, he, him, mm-hmm. but not my parents. And I was seeing a therapist, and I think she was a lesbian and her partner was a trans man. And for her, there was never any question of, am I trans or do I have dysphoria? Like, she never even investigated, or like, she was just like, yeah, you have dysphoria, you're trans. But she never like really probed or asked any questions. And then to get hormones, there's like multiple clinics or like health groups in Toronto that are specifically for trans people. But mm-hmm. they all have pretty long waiting lists, or they did at least back then. I haven't really checked up on them. But so the ways to get hormones based on the youth groups that I went to was like share with someone older who already has hormones, or go to, there are some trans doctors that would like slip you in after hours if you were trans and you just wanted hormones. And then there was like some new opening, like walking clinics that would like one day a week offer hormones. So what I ended up doing was like going to this one walking clinic where it was like, I think every Thursday, like it's open for trans people to come in and request hormones. And I went in and talked to the doctor, and I told him the name of my therapist, and he was like, oh yeah, I know her. Sure. No problem. And like wrote me the script, but like he didn't even ask, but I wasn't out to my parents and I was living with my parents, and she knew I wasn't out to them and I was living with them. So how was I supposed to take tea?
Is it by injection?
Yeah.
So it's not like a pill. It's hard to hide.
Yeah. Well, it's not that. It's that my voice would drop and I would grow facial hair and I would get like sweaty and I would gain weight and gain appetite. Like, I think my parents would have noticed. Mm-hmm, but yeah, it's usually like intramuscular. But I know some people who get like lots of scarring from that. So after a few years, they have to switch to just below the skin.
Right, right.
There are also, there's also a gel you can use, but some people find it like more annoying to use. But yeah, I was offered the injection, but I never did it because I was like, how can I do this when I'm closeted to my parents? Like, I knew from watching all the timeline videos, some trans guys, their voice drops within like the first 2 months.
Mm.
And I was like, my parents will notice that and be like, do you need to go to the doctor or something? What's wrong with you? Right.
Right.
Also, like, I have some neurological disorder that is similar to fibromyalgia, and I also have like ovarian cysts, and going on testosterone when you have those things is like the worst idea possible. And the doctor never asked me any questions about that and wasn't concerned and just gave me the script. Like, he didn't even check what other medications I was on.
And what have you learned about hormones? I mean, I know you're
a user. Yeah.
Right, but I'm sure you've read yes. about them. I mean, what have you learned that you didn't know when you got diagnosed, when you got the prescription?
Quite a few things. On the bottle, it literally says not for use by women. So I know people
but
who
you're
are
not a woman,
covered.
Right?
Covered.
You're right. You're a man.
So there are trans men who get their T covered by saying that it's, the doctor says that they're a man with low testosterone, and then it gets covered by insurance, because if they have their gender marker switched to male, the doctor can say that, right?
Right.
I also didn't realize, lots of trans men have eating disorders, and then they go on testosterone, which increases your appetite and makes you gain a bunch of weight. So as right. you can imagine, that's a problem for people with eating disorders. It also increases depression and anxiety, and lots of people who go on T already have those. Like, I know people who literally, they go into the therapist and they're like, I'm suicidal, my body is wrong, I need hormones. And the doctor is like, here's hormones, if you take them, you will feel better. And like, we know that actually causes an increase in depression. It also causes a huge increase in libido, like huge, off the charts. So if you're a teenager who's confused about your sexuality, or like me, whose libido is directly tied to the severity of the dysphoria, and then you go on this, it can make your dysphoria skyrocket, or it can like really, really mess with you psychologically if you're having issues with your sexuality and you're just like horny all the time. I know a few trans men who like got really, really into porn because they would like so aroused all the time. So like doctors are not checking up on these things once people go on them. I also know two people who've had testosterone-induced psychosis, and one of them was put in a mental hospital like multiple times, and every time they were in, the doctors just kept injecting the T because it said on their chart that's what they needed, even though the patient was like, maybe the T is the problem. So like, yeah, doctors refuse to like acknowledge the side effects could be making the patient worse because they think like T is the treatment, that's it.
Did your therapist try to deal with your other issues, like your eating disorder, or was it all entirely focused on your gender dysphoria?
I actually first saw my therapist for my family stuff, and that was like our biggest focus, was just like keeping my family life together. I actually ended up moving out from my parents when I was like 18.
Mm-hmm.
She never really addressed my other, like my body image issues. We mostly talked about like my family stuff and like just some basic techniques for managing anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I had a friend with severe body dysmorphia while I was seeing her, and I once asked her, like, can we use techniques from dialectical behavioral therapy or techniques for body dysmorphia to like manage or cope with my dysphoria? And she seemed like shocked that I was asking this question, that I would want to cope with my dysphoria, because she was like, what's the point if you're just going to get on T and it'll fix it?
Okay, well, that's a point worth exploring. So my understanding of body dysmorphia is that you're upset with the physical shape of your body.
Mm-hmm.
You're too fat, your breasts are the wrong size, or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's not sexual, in as opposed to gender dysphoria, where you're angry at your body because it's the wrong sex.
Yeah. So it's similar, but in dysphoria, it's specifically about your genitalia. And mm-hmm. usually in dysphoria, it's not just sex, it's also gender you have mm-hmm. problems with. So like the social aspect as well as the physical aspect.
Right.
And also in dysphoria, there's often like earlier childhood like indicators that you wouldn't have with dysmorphia. But the thing, they're actually pretty comparable, I think, because with dysmorphia, surgery is contraindicated. Right? Like if this person is obsessed that their calves are too small, the recommendation is not to get calf implants, right?
Yes.
Because when they do that, then they just fixate on a different part of their body. And similarly, mm-hmm. I know trans men who, they finally get mastectomy, and then they're completely obsessed with their hips being too big, or they're completely obsessed with their nose being too small, or something like that. Like it just shifts where they're focused.
Right, right.
So I think they are pretty comparable, and I don't understand why when therapists see somebody who presents with dysphoria, they don't question any of the similarities to other mental illnesses or other best practices with other mental illnesses.
So you had a lot of experience with people going through similar things, and presumably some of them have continued to transition, some have not.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your assessment about whether the transitioning helps? Ever. That's obviously changed for you, because you were going to transition and you changed your mind. So mm-hmm. it's not surprising that you don't think transition is for everybody. But I mean, have you seen some people for whom transition worked really well?
I have a few comments about that. So the first thing is, like, statistically, we know people who have sex dysphoria to the point where they need medical transition has always been a very small number, and in the last couple of years that number has exploded, and I don't think all of these people have sex dysphoria to the degree that they need transition, like medical mm-hmm. necessity. So that's my first point. So I think we're going to see a lot of detransitioners over the next couple of years.
Right.
My next point is that I think the people who are transition should be people who have sex dysphoria to a debilitating degree every single day. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be people who once a week get upset about their breasts, or once every couple of days are upset about gender roles, because those are the kinds of things that it's definitely less of a huge impact on your life to address those things in therapy than to radically change your legal status, your social status, your medical status, your body, right? Like
yes.
One of those things literally flips your life upside down. And I don't see why for a teenager, the first line of defense should be to flip their life upside down before you attempt any coping mechanisms. Another thing is, I think regardless of whether you're like truly trans or not, you need coping mechanisms for your dysphoria in case the treatment for your dysphoria makes it worse, because then you're really like up a creek without a paddle, you know?
Right. One of the things I found most upsetting is stories of detransition after steps have been made to physical transition. Hormones.
Yeah, I know people who've had like all of the surgeries and then they detransition.
And, you know, they must also realize that they've ruined their body in some ways. Right?
Yeah, that's the thing, that most of them are really, really angry at doctors, that the doctors let them do this. If you think about it, transition on its, like, without thinking about psychology, if you look at it in person physically, there is no medical reason to transition. Like, it's not like there's something wrong with your breast that they need to be removed.
Yes.
So you're literally taking healthy body parts and changing them to suit a condition of the mind, which is not static, right? If the condition of the mind changes, then the body is permanently altered to look that way. So yeah, like you said, I know people who they thought, like, after I finally have the last surgery, then I'll finally feel like a man, finally. And they get the last surgery and they're just like, now I have like 1 year of painful recovery time and I'm saddled with debt and I'm more depressed than ever and I don't feel like a man. So they're like, why did I do this to myself?
I think we have to go back to recognizing that sex is biological.
Mm-hmm.
And worrying about gender roles, because, you know, maybe, I mean, if somebody had told you that, had told you that being a lesbian is perfectly normal, that some percentage of women will be attracted to other women, not men, that, you know, you don't have to be a housewife, that you could, you know, you could be career oriented or, you know, other things other than staying at home having lots of babies. I mean, would that have maybe avoided this whole trauma you went through?
I think about that a lot. So I don't know if you've heard about this thing called MishFest, Michigan Women's Festival. But it got shut down a few years ago because some reasons, but they did like a tiny reboot and it's like a smaller version. And I went to this festival and it's literally women only. So there's no males on the land.
And so no trans women.
No trans women.
Which is where the controversy came from. Right?
Yeah, that's where it came from. But it was an amazing experience. I was 21. I met a bunch of butch lesbians who were just like happy in the way that they presented and they weren't trying to do anything. Like when I was trans, I was always trying to look like a boy. Even though my natural inclinations were kind of masculine, I was still stuffing myself in a box. And these women also, they were like walking around without their shirts on, carefree. They were like completely comfortable in their bodies. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time in my life that I saw like happy butch women who were just being themselves. And I really, really wonder if I had gone there when I was 12 or 13 before I discovered trans ideology, like how different it would have been. Because once I was into the ideology, once I believed that like I was secretly trans on the inside and I just didn't know it yet before this, and that like the only way to treat dysphoria is transition or else you'll kill yourself. Like before I believed all of those things, I think it would have made a difference to me. But also like a lot of people, transition is in some way rooted in an internalized homophobia. So it's also possible that seeing lesbians, I would have pushed even further and said, no, that's definitely not me.
Right. So sort of like the opposite of autogynephilia, it's kind of like you're disturbed by the sexual attraction that you're feeling.
100%, which is why I think there's, I theorize that a lot of gay trans men, so females who believe they are males, who are attracted to males, are actually lesbians because they're so disgusted with the concept of being a female with a female that they've gone as far to the extreme as possible, which is to be a male with a male.
Right. Right.
That's my theory anyway, because I know at least 5 women who, like me, believe they were gay trans men, and it turns out that they're lesbians.
In Iran, I think they have executed the people, homosexuals, I don't know if it's both men or women, but they're okay with transgender. So your solution is to get surgery, and then everybody's okay with you.
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody the other day who knows a lesbian who just moved here from Iran, and they literally said like the police gave them like 3 options, like go to the psych ward, transition, or leave the country, and they left the country.
Well, that's That's sad, like, how cultures bully people.
Mm-hmm. There definitely are right now, like, gay men in Iran getting sexual reassignment surgery. And I really, really am concerned that, like, even the best surgeons in the world, like, a lot of what they do is, I would qualify as unsuccessful. So I really am concerned, like, in countries like Iran, like, what quality of surgery and care the patients are getting, because I'm sure it's horrific.
I mean, as some women have pointed out, like, even a man who has his penis turned into an internal cavity, they're still not, it's still not a vagina and uterus. You know, it's still not a female organ.
Yeah. If you talk to these people, they say that it still smells like a penis. They still, like, when they're aroused, it's still, like, the way that the muscles and the tissue react is like a penis. That, like, everything about it is not, it's still male anatomy, just in, like, a convoluted shape, kind of.
Yes, and maybe, as you say, for a very small percentage of people, this is what they really want. They're willing to put up with all of that because they just can't stand being a man or a woman. But, I mean, as being pointed out by some of my other guests, the vast majority, like 80, over 90% of children that identify as trans in their young teens by the age of 20 will have decided that they're not.
Yeah.
And they've saved themselves, like yourself. I mean, despite the trauma you went through physically, you saved yourself having your breast removed. You saved yourself mm-hmm. from the health dangers of hormones.
Yeah.
So you're lucky compared with some people who went further than you and then decide to come back. And now, you know, they realize there is no way back.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah. Well, like, I think it's the Royal College of Physicians or something in the UK. A few weeks ago, they released a letter saying that there is no medical indication that trans children need puberty blockers. Because those people, unlike a lot of doctors, it seems, have actually read the studies that show that most trans-identified youth who are prepubescent or adolescent will desist by the age of 20, like you said. So we know that 100% of children who are put on puberty blockers are locked into the track of transition, and they will have dysphoria and be trans for the rest of their life, which is obviously medically and psychologically more taxing.
Well, I've just been reading. Desisted. I've just been reading, like, I think what's said about puberty blockers is one of the most horrifying lies. Puberty blockers can cause osteoporosis. So you end up with a 20-year-old who's hunched over because their bones are decaying.
Or need a hip replacement,
whatever. And it's been given for girls who had premature...
Precocious puberty,
but also for girls who wanted to be taller. And that's shocking because, again, like, there's no medical indication that says this girl needs to be taller, right? It's just either the parents or the child, it's vanity or some, you know, fear of being short, right? And there's nothing wrong with being a short person. And to take drugs that can cause permanent body damage to be taller or, you know, in the case of transgender, to hope that it will make you feel better about your gender. Mm-hmm. To me, it's pretty horrifying. And this lie that, you know, you can stop puberty blockers anytime and things will go back to normal. It's
literally a lie. Yeah. And also there's been research out of the UK that shows that the gender identity development services, that they've been doing like a publicly funded study. So some professor, I forgot his name, from Oxford, he requested like the information about the study. And I think it was something like most of the kids who were on the blocker showed their response to the question, do I want to hurt or kill myself, increased while they were on this drug. So clearly this is not helping them prevent suicide. It's increasing suicidality. And also there has been studies that show that children on puberty blockers lose IQ points.
Yes, they lose bone, they lose IQ points. It truly is horrifying.
It's a whole body thing.
What's also horrifying is we're running out of time. Well, maybe not horrifying, but we've been talking almost an hour. So, if you've got one more thing that you'd like to say before we wrap up, that'd be great.
I think that we need to make it not just socially accepted, but celebrated for children to be gender nonconforming and not transition. Because what you would have seen maybe like 10 years ago of like a boy dancing around the living room, dancing to like a Disney princess movie. Now when you see that, everybody's asking, is this kid trans? When are they transitioning? You know what I mean? Like, we need to make it more socially acceptable for kids to be gender nonconforming. We need to slow down with transition of children. Not to say that nobody should be transitioning or they shouldn't be receiving specialized care, but to say we need to address the psychological before we address the physical.
Yes.
At the very bare minimum. And I think that therapists and doctors and social workers and parents, they need to look at transition like any other mental health problem or any other medical problem. They shouldn't be treating it as something that unique where you can ignore medical standards or medical studies. You would never do that with any other issue. So, like, you would never give your kid an untested antibiotic, but why would you give them an untested hormone that will sterilize them?
I guess I would disagree with you there, because I think there's been a lot of untested drugs, but this is, like, one of the worst cases. Like, with antidepressants, they actually weren't tested properly to prove that they worked. But I think in this case, we're at a new level of bad, you know, in terms
of... Yeah, like, it literally says on the box, don't give it to women, and it's being given to females en masse.
Yeah, and there's no real evidence that it has any benefit. Mm-hmm. And we have all these health consequences.
There's been studies that show that females on testosterone have increased chances of developing dementia, and that the linguistic centers of their brain atrophy a bit.
Yes, I think there's really no question that there's significant health consequences in both directions, both for biological males and females. The health consequences are different, but they're severe in both cases. Mm-hmm. I would just like to thank you, Ben, for joining me today. I know you're really opening up yourself in a conversation like this. It's talking about a lot of sensitive issues, so I appreciate you sharing it, because I think it's important that people hear this perspective, which in the mainstream media is almost being vanished.
It's been censored. I know journalists who interviewed friends of mine, and then they can't run the story that they write.
Yes. Well, this is going to run, and after the podcast comes out, I'll send you a link, and you're welcome to share it with your network.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate broadening my platform, because as you said, like, this is an issue that's not being covered and not being discussed. I think it's really important to just get people to think about it instead of just blindly affirming, because the trans movement is not the same as the gay movement. You can't just accept it and not think about it anymore when it comes to children transitioning.
We put all the letters together and people laugh about how many there are, but the bigger question is do they all belong together? Like, a lot of lesbians are saying, we don't feel comfortable in this mishmash of letters. It's being taken over by the T, and the L is disappearing.
In a very literal sense.
Yes, and I've got to the point where we're sort of saying, okay, if you're not, quote, normal, like heterosexual, gender conforming, then, maybe we don't all belong together. Mm-hmm. Who came up with this idea?
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on. Have a nice day, David. Bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 231 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david@crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.